This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody. I have mumble mouth today. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and today's guest, Mr. Jesse Richard. Jesse, what's up, dude?
Oh, not much. We're just getting through this heat wave, hopefully.
Oh, man. And that's a great segment and that I want to kind of talk about right now. So I recorded an episode Friday morning, and it's been hot all weekend here. And I usually shut my air conditioner off in my office because it's not connected to the rest of my house, so I don't get central air up here. And the air conditioner was off all weekend. So when I came up here this morning, it was like 80 degrees, 85 degrees in this space above my garage. And so if you hear the audio quality right now might be a little, there might be some background noise. You might hear the hum of an air conditioner. I'm leaving it on because trying to record without it on after a whole weekend of just soaking, like even my desk is warm from it being so hot this weekend and no air conditioner running. So deal with it, I guess.
Yeah, your shirt would be a different color if you left it off by the time we were
exactly
done.
Exactly. That's a fact. Hey, this is how we started off, man. Jesse, why don't you talk to me a little bit about where you live and what do you do for a living?
So I live in Ankeny, Iowa now, which is a suburb right north of Des Moines. Been here since college, pretty much, at least in the metro. I own a carpet cleaning company here in town. I've been doing it on my own for 8 years. Grew up, my dad owned a carpet cleaning company. I never thought in a million years I'd be cleaning carpets. It wasn't a cool thing that my dad did, but you know, looking back, man, we never went without. We always had everything we needed. And I've since apologized to him for it. But yeah, it's it's a great time. I do that. I run some social media pages. So and then I edit all of our Outdoor X Media hunts and episodes and stuff like that. So
nice. I'll tell you this. There's always this weird, when you're young, you're like, I want to be a doctor. I want to be a lawyer. I want to do something cool. And then all of a sudden you get to this real world and it doesn't, like the title doesn't matter anymore. It all becomes like the money. Is the money good enough to survive? And so, although you may have thought that being a carpet cleaner was a boring, lame ass job, what you realized is that it doesn't matter what the work is, as long as the money's there, you can be golden.
Yeah, and it's a little bit of labor, and I did a bunch of jobs like out of high school and through college and bounced around a little bit. I did 10 years outdoor retail, you know, I was an archery tech, in multiple places around here. My first job was in Gander Mountain, Cedar Rapids, working on bows and guns and all that stuff. And that kind of was the perfect job for me because that's what I like to do anyways. So, yeah. You know, got a little bit of discount on all the stuff and got to talk to people every day that like to do what I like to do.
Yeah, that's a fact. So were you born in Iowa?
Yeah, I was born in northern Iowa. Up Humboldt is where I spent most of my life through high school. I was born way up by Minnesota, up in Estherville, up by Okoboji. But
okay,
before that, after that, it was all dropped down into Humboldt, which is right north of Fort Dodge. You know, it's one of them smaller towns that no one really knows where it is.
Yeah. This is great because I want you. Okay, wait, I got the perfect question to transition into deer hunting, but before we do, I got to send a shout out to all of the partners of the Nine Finger Chronicles. So bear with me just for a moment. But if you're looking for, in my opinion, actually, I just sent an email to Fred over at Wasp. If you're looking for some of the best, in my opinion, best broadheads on the market from a material, from a design standpoint, and the fact that whatever they hit, they just straight up destroy. And ultimately, that is what you want a broadhead to do. Go check out wasparchery.com. I do have a discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Code Blue Scents. Code Blue offers a variety of scent elimination products, real and synthetic deer urines. I am looking, not this week, but next week, it will be a priority to go out and get my trail cameras up, to get my mock scrapes, the Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kits freshened up. So I'm really looking forward to that. So go check out codebluescents.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Vortex Optics. Vortex has been a supporter of the Nine Finger Chronicles for a long time. And if you're looking for spotting scopes, rifle scopes, red dots, binoculars, rangefinders, and all the accessories you need, like for mounting on guns and whatnot, go check out vortexoptics.com. Great people, love the products, and I'm happy to be partnered with Vortex. Then next on the list is, what do we got? Vapor Trail Rests. I used to shoot Ripcords, and then Ripcords sold to a big giant company and the quality took a shit. And now I am shooting Ripcords, or not Ripcords. Holy shit. I don't have enough coffee in my blood today, obviously. Now I'm shooting Vapor Trail because I got a little suggestion from a friend who was also shooting Vapor Trail. And now I'm so confident in Vapor Trail that they haven't left my bow in, like, I don't even know, like, 5 years, 6 years or something like that. I've been shooting a Vapor Trail limb driven system. So go check out Vapor Trail Archery and go check out their full lineup of arrow rest. Then we have Ozonics. Ozonics is on the list. And that's a crazy product that a lot of guys talk shit on. And they say, play the wind, do all this. I don't care. I have seen some amazing things happen with an Ozonics in my tree. Even when the thermals are pulling down and my scent is going right to their nose, it distorts it enough to have them almost be confused. It's not like they don't smell you. They smell a different version of you. And then sometimes they just walk through. Sometimes they get closer. Sometimes they may even work away, but it's not a full blown bust. And that's kind of why I pull an Ozonics in the tree with me every single hunt. So go check out ozonicshunting.com. And I think that's it, right? Vortex Wasp. Yeah, that's it. So go check out those. Go check out those brands. And please, support the companies that support this podcast. Okay, Jesse, thank you for your patience there.
No problem.
Iowa. Okay, there's a Boone and Crockett behind every tree in Iowa. Okay. But what people don't understand about Iowa is that north of Interstate 80, it's flat as shit. It's farm to the fences, very little cover compared to the southern part of the state. So it's almost like you're dealing with a different monster. Talk to me a little bit about what northern Iowa is like versus southern Iowa, as far as the Iowa, the Mecca of deer hunting.
Yeah, so I didn't bow hunt a bunch when I was in high school. I was never really introduced into it. I think I was probably 14 or 15 when I started bow hunting. And I was fortunate enough, Humboldt, geographically, it sits in between the east and the west fork of the Des Moines River. So a lot of people may not know that north of Humboldt, it actually splits off into two forks. So right around there, you do have a river system and all that. But you get outside of that, and it is a bunch of creek lines, which are almost gone now. And, you know, there's a little bit of public, but you got to find water up there to really get a big bunch of trees, because there's everything's flat. And like you said, for farm ground, and I'm sure it's even worse now than it was, you know, 25 years ago when I was in high school. So, I do have buddies that live up there that consistently kill quality, you know, 150 plus deer every year, but it's along those river systems, you know, and you get a river system next to an ag source, you know, it's easier to pattern them up there in with that train of thought, because there's not a lot of places for them to go compared to like Southern Iowa, where one of the farms I hunt, it's over 1,000-acre block with all the neighbors without a single road going through it.
Right. Right. And up there, everything is sectioned. Mile here, mile there, farming ground in between. So it sounds like, unless you have access to a private piece of property on a river, you get away from that river system and the cover along the river, it then becomes a little bit more difficult to locate and consistently kill deer.
Yeah, it's almost like a checkerboard. You know, I've been to a couple different states driving through where it's like Ohio is one of those, in a lot of parts where it is a checkerboard. Like everything is split up in one section's wheat, one section's beans, one section's corn. And if you look at it from a map, it literally looks like a bunch of squares. The nice thing about Northern Iowa is they have all the food they're ever going to want. It's they're very the deer are very pockety. You'll get a few deer here, a few deer there. But one thing with Iowa, with our antlerless tags, is there's nothing up there. There's zero doe tags in a lot of the northern counties. And when you get closer up to Minnesota, I got buddies that hunt along those waterways, and they'll have 200 deer late season on a food source. You know, so it's just like Southern Iowa, but they can't manage it. Because in general, it's so vast, but there's little pockets of honey holes.
Yeah. It's, that's where it gets crazy, right? I think there's like 16 counties in northwest Iowa, maybe even more. I'd have to look at the map, that you're not allowed to shoot a doe because of that. However, if you go pocketing, is what I'm getting at. The pockets of deer and the available cover are crazy. You move out there, and let's say some DNR officer drives through and does a deer survey, and he counts two deer in a square mile. Meanwhile, a mile closer to the river, where there's probably not a road that goes through some of these pockets, you're going to get a completely different vibe of, you know, deer. And I think a lot of that, I mean, you kind of look at a state like Montana and the Milk River, and how the river there was just loaded with deer. And maybe you move outside of that and it wasn't like that anymore. It wasn't loaded. And then the disease comes through. And I don't know, has there been big, I know in Southern Iowa there has been in the past, but when EHD came through Iowa, was Northern Iowa affected by that at all? Do you know of?
Not nearly like it was down south, just, you know, because the deer they're not confined to one little pocket, so they're really not spreading it. So if it doesn't pop up in this little section, the deer aren't going to get affected. But I'm sure there were pockets, you know, just like everywhere else, where, hey, yep, this did happen here, did happen there. But for the most part, the little bit I talked to the buddies up there that hunt, they find a few dead deer every now and then, but it's nothing like, you know, Southern Iowa's been hit with.
Yeah, absolutely. I figured that there would have been like a, if it hits up there, it hits real bad. But then again, I know, you know, not a lot of people talk about Northern Iowa as far as, you know, big deer hunting is concerned. Do you think that if this was a, you know, a conversation between a non-resident and, you know, like if you were going to give advice to a non-resident who finally drew an Iowa tag, Do you think it would be worth looking into northern Iowa, north, even northwest Iowa, in that farm country to possibly find a honey hole that nobody knows about?
Oh, 100%. I mean, like I said, it's not as open and stuff as I'm making it out to seem. There's a decent amount of ground, but you're more likely to, I would go out in the summer, in the spring, you know, make multiple trips out here. Don't just think, well, I'm going to show up in October and go pound on some public and, mm-hmm. and shoot a booner, you know, but
yeah.
If you put in your homework and you talk to some private landowners, you would be surprised, you know, what you could come up with.
Yeah.
And even I got buddies that hunt and, you know, like, well, we shoot one deer a year because that's all we can shoot, or two, you know, I guess with a gun, but mm-hmm. there's plenty of deer to go around in a lot of spots. And, you know, there is a little bit of Iowa nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell you this. When you're talking about two different cultures too, right? Everything south of Des Moines and south of Interstate 80 is the Iowa hunting industry, right?
Yeah.
That is yep. where all the big dogs have their farms. That's where all the management happens. That's where, I'm not saying all of it, but that's where a majority of the leasing and the outfitting and all of that stuff is happening. You remove yourself from that up into a different pocket of the state, like northwest Iowa, where deer hunting is not as popular as it is in the southern part of the state. You might be able to find a farmer who has a pocket of timber or a fence row or a corner of their property that hugs up against a river like that, and they don't give a shit about hunting. They actually want deer off their property. And if you could find that, that might be an opportunity if you're willing to put in the work.
Yeah. I mean, 100%. You get up there and you do you drive around and you just start door knocking. I mean, most of the guys up there are not going to be negative. You may not get a yes, but I would say you're going to get 10 times the no's in southern Iowa compared to 100%. Northern Iowa. And there are opportunities for just as big a deer. I mean, I have multiple buddies that have killed deer, you know, 190 plus north of 80, like way north of 80. You know, yeah. Those top two counties, tiers, close to Minnesota, that have killed some absolute giant deer.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So how many hours or days just at... let me back up just one second. Do you ever go out of state to hunt whitetails?
I have. I've been to North Dakota twice to try to kill a velvet. Not successful either time. I've been to Kentucky to try to kill a velvet. Left after 2 days because it was like 105 degrees the first week. It was awful.
Yeah.
And then I actually drew a tag for Nebraska this year.
Okay. All right. So, but for the most part, you're putting a lot of your... Go ahead.
I did hunt Missouri 1 year. I had tagged out like October 25th or something here. And I was like, well, what am I going to do all November? So in Missouri's over the counter for archery. And so I went down there and I actually knocked on four or five doors, got on a 40-acre piece from a little old lady, good timber, had a couple deer on trail camera, hunted it half a dozen times, and just never got the opportunity of shooting one I wanted to shoot. But yeah, I mean, even there, like I just drove around and kind of knocked on doors. So it's, they're out there.
Yeah. And so out of the course of a single year, how much time do you feel like you dedicate towards hunting in your entire life? Like, is it the main thing of your life?
Besides my kids and family and stuff like that. Yeah. Yep. I mean, it's second for sure. My kids are, I have two girls. They're a little bit older now. The oldest one's in high school. The other one's, you know, almost there. And they do gymnastics and volleyball and track. So it's 365 days a year for that stuff. And I try to be as present as I possibly can. Yeah. But if it's not that, it's hunting 100%.
All right, guys, you know me, and I love eating wild game, but I don't eat wild game every single night. Every once in a while, I'll reach for a side of beef, and that's why I trust Omaha Steaks. Because Omaha Steaks are sent directly to my door, I can keep my freezer stocked without having to go to the grocery store. It's honestly like having a trusted butcher and gourmet food shop right at your house. Last week, I pulled out their pure ground ribeye burgers for a quick grill session. The flavor and marbling was unreal, rich, juicy, and miles ahead of any average grocery store meat. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF, for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan and Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan & Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
Yeah. How many days would you say you dedicate towards bow hunting or hunting in general every single year compared to maybe 10 years ago?
So I kind of went in a little bell curve, maybe the opposite. So when I graduated high school in 04, I moved to Iowa City, was there for 4 years. And before I had kids, I hunted a lot. And yeah. Then when the kids were younger, you kind of back off on it. Mm-hmm. And they got a little bit older and they didn't need constant attention. Mm-hmm. So I ramped it up. But actual hunting, I've kind of backed off on it even a little, like backed off on it. My kid, my oldest one, has a school permit and can drive around and do a lot of stuff. I backed off on the number of days I actually hunt. I'm doing stuff a lot. Yeah. But actual sitting in a tree trying to kill a deer, less than I did 10 years ago. I would say, it's 30 to 50 days during the season, I would bet, that I hunt.
Yeah.
You know, so it's still a lot, but at the end of the day, it's a lot of them are not focused on trying to kill a buck.
Yeah. So if some of those days are not actually hunting, you're talking about like scouting or putting in food plots or like habitat improvement or checking trail cameras. Does that include that?
If you're talking everything out of 365 days a year, it's probably 300 days a year.
Okay. That's crazy.
Like, just at some level, whether it's, you know, prep at home, you know, trail camera stuff or shooting my bow or, you know, on another side, going through footage from past years. But yeah, it's almost every single day.
Yeah. Okay. That's crazy, man. Like I used to be that. For some reason, I used to be the guy who was like, man, especially if I knew there was a giant deer out there who I knew was alive. I don't know what it is, and I don't know why. It was almost like a drug. It was like I was obsessed with finding. I went through like a phase of, I don't know what the term would be, like absorbing knowledge or learning more about the deer movement on a given farm, or wanting to be out there and scout all times of years and running trail cameras 365 days a year. Or, you know, then when digital mapping came out, dude, there were days where I would spend hours on Onyx or some type of mapping software or Google Maps or Google Earth and like go into every angle possible. And then just like where I spent most of my time and it was just in thought is like closing my eyes and visualizing on different wind directions, access routes to a ridge point or to a river bottom stand or to in a pinch point, or, you know, like, okay, is that the same access route that I would have if thermals are going down versus thermals going up? Is it an afternoon hunt? Is it a morning hunt? And almost like a choose your own adventure story that was playing out in my head every single day, to the point where I just couldn't keep up with that anymore, especially with like three kids and activities and all of that stuff. It was mind blowing how much I thought about access routes, dude. It was so stupid.
Yeah, it's definitely different than it was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago with technology. You know, a lot. Yeah. I do let cameras scout a lot more, and my access has dwindled crazy in the last even 5 years. You know, 5 years ago, I probably had 8 to 10 farms all over, you know, within 100-mile radius of my house. And now I have 3. And one of them is a family farm, one of them I own, and then another one is a neighbor's family farm. So it's just access has gone away for whatever reason. And it's a little bit different now. I've focused so much more on the couple of farms that I hunt a lot that I kind of step back and look at those and go, okay, I've been hunting here for 20 years. What is something I can explore to, you know, change that up a little bit? Not so much you get comfortable. If you hunt somewhere so long, you get really comfortable and lazy on where you're going to hunt. Like 100%. Where the stand I shot my buck out of last year, I had hung it that year. I'd looked at that tree for 15 years and was like, that'd be really nice to have a stand in, you know? And finally was like, I can get in there. It's going to take some trimming. It's going to take some, you know, stick on this side of the limb. I'm going to have to use this branch to get up here and I might have to trim this out, but I can get up in there. And it worked perfectly. So, you know, that's one thing. If you hunt a spot a lot is kind of get off of your, you know, the lazy train and figure something else out.
Yeah. That's hard to break. That those habits are hard to break. I had a conversation with a guy, I don't know if it was earlier this week or last week. I was talking to a guy about access routes per usual and how my access routes, when I would take so much care of my way in, but then I would straight line it to my truck when the hunt was over, right? Walk through whatever I didn't care. I just wanted to get back to the truck. And so I since have had to learn, you either take that same access route out if all conditions are the same, or if it's an evening hunt and you used a field to get to that stand, then I'm not using that field, that destination food source, to get back to my truck. I'm going through the timber or, you know, you call them dead zones where deer are not at certain times of day and things like that. And so, or moving that tree stand 5 yards or 10 yards for the better spot, man. That was such a hard habit for me to break, is to fall in. Well, I'm just at that point, I'm just hoping they come in instead of knowing they're going to come in.
Right. Yeah, it's so, and that's part of the fun of it too. And I'm the same way with trail cameras. Like I have cameras that I've had, or certain trees I've had cameras on for 15 years. Yeah. You know, and some of them have died over the years where they're just, you know, 10 years ago it was awesome because they used a certain, you know, trail or that there was a certain scrape line they like to hit. But then a neighbor does some TSI or, you know, the crop rotation's different and it's not as good. And you can look at it and go, well, I'm wasting a camera here you know, maybe I go try to find somewhere else. You do a little bit of walk and you're like, oh, I didn't realize this was here. This is why there's a, you know, this giant oak tree fell down. Of course, they're not coming up here anymore. And once again, breaking that habit of being lazy and this is how I've always done it, you know, is,
yeah,
it was hard, but I'm getting more and more into accepting it, I guess.
Yeah. You brought up a buzzword there that I don't know if a lot of people, I mean, I know people have talked about it, but no one really goes into too much detail about it. Talk to me about the buzzword crop rotation and what that means for you.
Well, I mean, the easiest way to say it is most farm ground in Iowa gets rotated between corn and beans every year just for the, so there's less inputs with fertilizer and different things from year to year to year. And, you know, you can run into different yields and all that stuff. And I'm nowhere near a farmer, so I can't really talk about a lot of that. But I have noticed that deer will completely do different things if it's corn or if it's beans. And that's just from year to year, but even time of year, when those fields, when that corn gets above, you know, knee high into waist high, there'll be times those deer don't leave it. They will just live in that corn because they have everything they need. They may get out in the middle of the night and move around, or you'll find them in a waterway. But, and then of course, beans are where the deer love to eat. You know, everyone films velvet deer, goes for a drive, and, you know, they're checking out the big bean fields, the big destination bean fields, because that's where the deer are going to go eat. In 1 year, you'll have it, and then the next year, you won't. You just have to kind of figure it out. And everybody's property is a little bit different. One thing I've learned to do, especially since buying my own farm, I just have a little 40-acre piece in southern Iowa I bought, but the crop rotation in the neighborhood, you know, even like a mile away will dictate the deer I get on camera before like the rut. I don't have a lot of deer on my farm during the summer because I don't have a lot of food. It's mostly CRP, but I can tell you when the neighbor 3/4 of a mile to the north has beans that it sucks the deer over there. And when it's corn, I will actually get more pictures of deer during the summer because they're not living right there. They're going past me to go through somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you this, man, let's say my river bottom farm that I have access to, when the river bottom is in corn, it holds more does, which makes the rut more fun down in the river bottom. But when it's a bean year in the river bottom, the quantity of the deer, there's still a homebody doe group that lives down there and they still maybe pop into that, but it's almost like the soybean field is not a destination food source like a corn field is a destination food source after it gets picked. And so, and a lot of that might have something to do with the combining methods or whatever that is, but I always have my better years when wherever, I shouldn't say better years. What I should say is I'm focusing more on picked corn than I am in November than I am in picked soybean fields, if that makes sense.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I would 100% agree that the amount of times I've sat over fields, and this is a farm I can't hunt anymore, a little bit closer to Des Moines, and they would rotate their crop. And I can tell you, when they pick the beans, you'll get some does and they'll pop out there a little bit and you might get a buck following them out there during the rut to check them. But when it's cut corn, that's where the deer are going. Like they're going out.
It just seems to be loaded. Yeah.
Yep. Every chance. And whether it's the combining practices and everything's so efficient with the soybeans or the corn and you're getting more, you know, coon damage with knocking ears down. And so it's left over, you know, it doesn't get hit right. I don't know. Once again, I don't really know what else the deer are really picking, but it seems they'll live in that cut cornfield and eat on it all winter long. Where a cut bean field, they kind of go away from it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, obviously if there's any type of standing beans late season, it almost seems like they prefer that a little bit more, but I'm not 100% sure that that is exactly what they're eating. I don't know. Like, I know that, when I have hunted late season, which I don't put a lot of energy into late season, when I have hunted late season, if there is any type of standing beans, they're favoring that late season over corn, standing corn. I did have one year where it got wet in late November or late October, early November. So they just, and then it snowed. So then they waited and actually combined in December when the ground was frozen. And so I had a couple weeks of that late season, post shotgun season, late season opportunity to go and hunt over top of that. And they were picking standing beans over standing corn every day. And maybe that has to do with the amount of work and how their bodies are built, and they just bend down and eat compared to like having to knock over a stalk or turning their head sideways to pull a ear of corn off or whatever the case is. But the second that it got picked, they then switched to the corn. So that tells me that it has something to do with the ease of how they get their calories.
Yeah, I mean, they're conserving as much energy as they can, especially when it's cold.
Yeah.
And the one thing I have found with beans, I had a farm that it almost planted itself. Like we had got a big, it was either a rainstorm or a windstorm that came through after the beans had turned pretty yellow and almost brown.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the pods got busted up and all that. And it actually re-germinated with the beans that had fallen on the ground. So you had a bunch of 2-inch bean pods that had sprouted and they were eating the greens out there in December because it hadn't froze yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, for the most part, that's what I've seen is if they're standing beans, which is what I try to do in my small, like little kill plots, I've tried to do corn. But you're fighting the coons so bad. If you don't have 3 or 4 acres of corn, like I hot fence my stuff, but you're still fighting the raccoons worse than the deer.
Do you have a lot of coon damage to your crops or to your food plots at all, out of curiosity?
Yeah, there's, so on my uncle's farm is one of the main farms that I hunt. When it is corn, it gets absolutely destroyed. Especially when we do like a 1 acre of, you know, there's one finger of the ag that the farmer just doesn't plant. He lets us do whatever. And last year it was an acre, little over an acre and a quarter. And it looked awesome. Like this time of year was getting ears on it. Mm-hmm. By the time season rolled around, there was 90% of the corn was gone.
Yeah. That's crazy. Right. Because a hot fence, like you mentioned, what you do on some of your properties, doesn't work for coons, right? They can get right under, get right underneath of it or find a way to get into that. Do you, from a food plot or standing corn, standing bean standpoint, do you ever trap to try to mitigate some of that?
Yeah, I actually love trapping. I grew up trapping. You know, it used to be profitable when I lived right out of high school into college. I used to trap coon all the time, but they were $20 on carcass. It was a great time to be a trapper. But now, and that farm is an hour and 10 minutes from my house. So it's not feasible to trap it like I would want to. A lot of times I will do it during season. Like once trapping season opens up and I can target bobcats and stuff like that, a lot of times I'll run, you know, 20 or 30 traps on that farm, you know, half a dozen for predators and then a bunch of, you know, foothold or coon cuffs, dog proofs for coons. But I don't go right there because I'm hunting right there. The last thing I want to do is go to walk in the morning to hunt and there's 5 coons squealing because they're in traps, you know, that doesn't really work.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you got to dedicate something, some amount of time to it if you're going to be serious about it. I mean, I've heard of guys catching 250 coons on a 100-acre or 200-acre property, and that's like one raccoon per acre. That seems crazy to me that there's that there's that many raccoons out there right now. But talking to an Iowa wildlife biologist, they are the most overpopulated animal in North America. And that's why you see them all over the roads dead. I saw five crossing the road at one time the other day in the middle of the day. So it's crazy how much damage they can do to a cornfield in a summer, dude. It blows my mind.
Yeah. And the sad thing is if your whole neighborhood isn't on the program of we're going to try to kill as many as we can, it's literally pointless. Like you could kill, you know, 100 a year on like 40 acres. You probably could. If I ran traps all year round, you know, 20 traps all year round, I could easily kill 100 coon on there. And the day I would stop, I'd have coons on camera.
Right.
Because if the neighbors in the whole section aren't doing it, it's, you are helping a little bit, but not to what you could be.
Exactly.
So that makes it really rough. And it's just, it sucks. But that's kind of why I quit running corn during the summer for like inventory.
Yeah.
When, you know, when I was younger, I would pull my pickup to a co-op and fill the bed of my truck with corn.
Yeah.
Cost me $100. And I would just drive it down there and I'd get the big scoop shovel and I'd go to one spot, put out a couple hundred pounds, throw a camera on it and try to do inventory for deer. But you'd end up, there'd be nights where you'd have 10, 20 coons in one picture.
Yeah. So essentially you're feeding raccoons.
You're feeding the coons and you'd get deer every once in a while. So I will do inventory one time on farms in like the last decade. That's why I will go out like late August and put out like a bag of corn, which I know will be gone in 2 or 3 days, but just try to get those deer to, you know, hey, who was close to the camera, but maybe this will help them come in a little bit closer. But looking back, I used to spend so much money and time on putting corn out and I was feeding raccoons.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You mentioned there something about like the neighborhood needs to be on board. Talk to me about maybe how, or maybe you do, or maybe you don't, talk to the neighbors on, I mean, do you have conversations with some of the neighbors on some of the properties that you hunt where you're trying to manage for big deer or putting in food plots of like, hey, this year I'm doing this, or this year I got a trail camera of a beautiful 3-year-old that I want to pass. Like, do you have those conversations?
it's funny you bring that up. I'm going to tiptoe around it a little bit. On one of the farms that I hunt, there is a neighbor that is very, very, very particular on his stuff. Like if he could have every deer be 7 years old, he would.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago, I shot a buck that I was pretty sure he was 4. It's that one. I mean, he's mid-70s. As a typical, and I knew he was at least 4. I had pictures of him at 3, had him at 4. And I'm like, and I even told the neighbor in conversation, like, I don't know if I can pass him. He might be the biggest deer I've ever killed. I don't know if I can pass him. And I shot him late season and he was not thrilled. He found out through social media that I'd killed it, was very upset about it. And it's been kind of a no-go zone ever since then. Well, I just have cut all ties. I don't try to text him. It's been a situation. So
okay,
I'm just I'll leave that at that.
Yeah. So let's talk. I want to talk. How many acres do you own?
So that is my uncle's, and it's 220 acres.
Okay. Okay. And that is your uncle's 220 acres. And how many guys hunt that?
Me and him.
Me and him. Two guys. Okay. And is there egg on it? Does it get farmed?
A little bit. Mostly the front. There's probably 10 to 15 acres in the front that gets pulled off, but we don't hunt right there. So it's not such a big deal. And then there's another 10 acres that kind of get planted, but aren't really taken care of. So it doesn't really amount to much.
Yeah. Okay. And how much does this other guy own out of curiosity? How many acres?
Over 1,000.
Over 1,000. Okay. That's what I'm talking about, dude.
Like, and I mean, I, I get it. Like, I will be the first one to, I get it. This deer had the potential to be, who knows? But then again, we get EHD about every other year down there, and there's an, you know, a highway really close, and there's a million things that can happen. And I wanted to shoot the deer, so I shot it.
But here's what I'm getting at. He got mad at you for shooting a deer on your property. Dude, I've had this happen before. Okay. And that guy got pissed and he sent me a whole bunch of text messages about what I should and should not shoot. And then also he started sending me pictures of deer that he passed. And he passed 190-inch deer that year. And telling me I should probably do the same because he's telling me I should probably get to like my goal should be 200. He's telling me what my goals are.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when I hear a story like that and I hear someone shit talk or basically get pissed at you because you did what you wanted to do on your farm on a deer that was mature. And who is going to pass? What percentage of people are going to pass a 170-inch deer?
Yeah.
It's
not very many.
Not very many. And so whenever I hear stories like that, I get pissed off and I get really pissed off, right? Because I'm going to shoot whatever I want. And if you're going to, I'd have some words for that guy face to face next time I saw him. Like, I don't know.
It was, and the worst thing is like, I respect him because of what he's done for hunting but it's always kind of been like this. Like he's always kind of had that standard of hire. So, you know, we do one shotgun drive through it a year and I would get a text, what'd you guys shoot? Mm-hmm. Well, we shot four does and somebody shot like a 7 point, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, and I've always been honest. I've never not been honest with him about any of it. And like I said, I can understand the thought process behind it. And, you know, 10 years ago, the first, you know, 3-year-old want 120, 130 inch buck that would come by, I was going to shoot, you know, and then you just kind of progress. And maybe I'll get to that point where I am passing those 170s. You know, I don't know. I don't think I can fathom it. Yeah. Did the deer have more potential? Yeah, it probably did. But once again, it's got to run the gauntlet, because I think the average deer lifespan is 3.5 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless it's on 1,000 acres of highly managed property. Right.
Yep.
And so like a guy I'm assuming, and this is just an assumption, you shoot a 4-year-old 170-inch deer. Okay. I'm assuming that deer's lifespan is on two different properties. Okay. He shows up on yours, you shoot him. Maybe that's the case. Maybe it's not. Obviously that guy knew about him because he probably had trail camera pictures of him. I'm assuming. Right.
Yeah.
So
now they had passed shot him a bunch too.
Yeah. Okay. Right. I'm almost positive that in 1,000 acres, and if that guy's so worried about that one 170-inch 4-year-old, he probably has another 170-inch 4-year-old on that property, if not bigger, that he could chase or pass or do whatever he wants to. So the fact that he got upset with you just still, dude, that shit rubs me the wrong way in a major way. You want to talk about hunters trying to in some way, shape or form unite. Like I joke around with the crossbow thing quite a bit.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a joke, right? If you want to shoot a crossbow, shoot a crossbow. I don't give a shit. But when you got another hunter who owns 1,000 acres telling another person who hunts less than that about how they should manage deer, go fuck yourself is what I say. And I'm sorry, but that is one thing that I cannot handle because it's happened to me before. I hear it from other guys as well. And it just gets me fired up, man. Like it gets me fired up when I hear stories like that.
Yeah, it bothered me at first. And then now I'm to the point where, you know what, he's probably never been honest with me about anything he's ever told me about what's going on his side.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, So why would it matter? And I mean, so I had shot a really nice buck with my bow in November. Mm-hmm. And he had texted me, "Hey, saw you bringing a four-wheeler in the farm, you know, what'd you shoot?" And I called him and told him, and, you know, I had brought up, you know, "Oh, you know, I had this deer on camera for a few years," and he's like 6 or 7 years old. I mean, it's a fully mature deer. And then I asked him, I'm like, "So have you seen, do you have pictures of the big typical?" And he's like, "What?" I'm like, "The big, you know, the big 6x6. And he's like, "Honestly, I wasn't even going to tell you about him." So he had known about him, and I'm like, "Well, I had pictures of him last year, and I got pictures of him this year." And he was like, "Yeah, I wasn't even going to bring him up." Like, yeah.
He's not going to tell you anything, but he expects you to tell that guy everything. Fuck that, dude.
Right.
Fuck him.
After the fact, there was in part of the conversation, last conversation I ever had with him, after him like berating me about all of it, was we as a collective neighborhood had all said we were going to pass this deer. And I told him, I was like, "I wasn't part of that text conversation. If you would have," and here's the thing, like, if he would have come to me and said, "Hey, Jess, we're all trying to pass this deer.
Yeah.
What do you think about it?" And I would have, honestly, I'll tell you right now, I would have passed him. If they would have come to me and said, "Hey, this is the one deer we're really, really wanting to get one more year out of," I would have passed him.
Yeah.
And so it kind of comes back to, if you just want to be a normal human being and a good person and have conversations about this, I'm very, very up for it. Yeah. But to just play it and hide it and then get mad that I shot the second biggest deer I'd ever killed, like,
all of this over a deer. Over a mm-hmm. deer, right? And then, okay, yep. So then people who are in this deer management world, right, they'll say, "I get it. I understand," because of all the time and energy and money that an individual puts into that. I still don't give a shit how much time, energy, or money you dedicate, or if, let's say this is an industry person, if that then means that they make more money. I still don't give a shit.
Yep.
If it happens on a different property, you just say congratulations, and that's all you do. Right.
Yep.
Especially if they're not in communication with you. If they're going to be cool and be like, "Hey, listen, I've talked to a couple landowners. We're going to try to pass this buck." And then they say to you, "What do you think about that?" And if you say, "Yes, cool, cool, awesome." If you say, "No, this buck is 100% on my hit list," then they can say, "All right, man, good luck." Right. Who gives a shit? Oh my God. Something about, dude, I have seen friendships, hardcore friendships, get lost because two guys shared a lease or a farm. One guy got a picture of a big buck, then didn't tell anybody, or found a shed and didn't tell them. And then they both knew about the buck, but still didn't, you know, then they started going after him, and then they're like, "Hey, well, I'm going to hunt here. Well, I plan on hunting here." And then they start arguing about it. Then it comes out that there's a giant there, and then they're going in at different times and lying and cheating. And then the friendship's over, right?
Yep.
Over a fucking deer. Blows my
yep.
mind, dude. Blows my mind.
Yep. 20 years ago, it might, you know, it's a little bit different, you know, like you could see the headspace of it, but mm-hmm. anymore, I don't care. I mean, there's deer that disappear every year, and it is what it is. If you can, the best you can do is whatever you can personally do, and the chips are going to fall where they may. And
there's no right. You have no right to go. I mean, it's a free country. You can do or say whatever you want to anybody you want. That's fine. If you want to be that asshole, well, go be that asshole. But man, whatever, dude. Anyway. And so now this guy has I'm guessing you're not talking to him. He's not talking to you. So now that guy lost information. Like he's yeah. lost, you know, you could shoot a giant that is on his property and I wouldn't even tell anybody anything about that farm anymore. I wouldn't post it on social media until the season's over. That's me, right? Like yeah. make this guy go hunt a dead deer and waste his time on that property hunting a deer that doesn't exist anymore. And so I was like, hey, I saw you driving a four-wheeler. Yep. Checking trail cameras. Saw you driving that four-wheeler down. Did you shoot a deer? No, I'm just going for a ride. Right? Like, dude, you would get nothing out of me after something like that happened. I'm telling
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I have had, since the day after I killed the deer, I have had zero contact with him.
Good
straight,
for you.
Is a straight person, one for the other. And it's mutual. And, you know, and I get it. But, I mean, there's a whole nother, I mean, we could do 2 hours on the debacle that has happened since then. But yeah. I don't want to get fired up. And like I said, I still, even though it probably isn't deserved, I try to still respect it, I guess, of just, I'm not going to.
Good for you.
Make it, doesn't need to make a thing. And like, I want to be super bitter about it and just be like, yep, this is who it is. But at the end of the day, it doesn't help anybody either.
Yeah.
Nope. And that's so I've kind of moved on and I'll take care of my stuff and it is what it is. So, and the thing is, at any point in time, I could run into him and have a conversation and we could be good. And I would just pick up right there and be, yep, we're good. Because I'm over it. You know, I would prefer to have that a little bit of friendship again. But if it happens, it happens, but I'm not going to seek it out.
Yeah. You don't need to, man. Okay. We got 12 minutes left, roughly. Tell me a cool big buck story.
Oh man. I got a couple. Probably my favorite one is a buck I called BB-8. His big browed 8-pointer was his name. He's the one I killed that same year with the debacle of the big typical. But I'd had pictures of him for 3 or 4 years and he was the same thing. He was tight framed, big brow tines. There's something about the genetics on that farm. Like the average brow tine on that farm is 5 inches plus. This one has like 8-inch brow tines. So he was always on the radar, found a shed the year before I killed him turkey hunting. And I got a spot on the farm that is way, way in the back. It goes against a lot of the don't walk through your farm to, you know, hunt a certain, you know, you don't want to blow out deer and access and all that. But I hunt it like 1 or 2 days a year during the rut where I know, hey, deer are going to be everywhere. And you're going to get busted at some point from some deer, but you do what you can. You just get in there and hunt. So that's what I did that morning. And the night before, I had almost killed my number one hit list deer on that farm. He came in with a doe, just showed up at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This is the first week in November. Mm-hmm. So didn't get this buck killed. So I'm like, you know what? He had a hot doe. He was with a hot doe. I'm going to go back in there in the morning. I get in there super slow the first hour or two, see a couple little bucks cruising, and then it starts going nuts. Probably 150 yards away in the timber, I hear a huge buck fight. I mean, logs going crazy, trees breaking, sounding like, you know, like the loudest rattling session you've ever made. Deer grunting and growling, going nuts. And then dead silent. 10 minutes later, I just see flashes of tail for coming from that area and start hearing grunting. And here comes this little buck and then another little buck and then another little buck. And then a doe comes barreling through and right behind her is this buck I call BB-8. And they were around me for like 2 hours before I ever got a shot. But there were, I think at one point, there were 13 different bucks around my tree stand, all inside 75 yards.
That's bananas.
Anywhere from like a spike to this was the biggest, oldest mature deer. you know, two or three three-year-olds. I think there was another four-year-old in there, but they would not leave this area. And he had her pinned down, and you would see another buck would kind of get too close, and he'd spin and run him off. And this went on for like an hour of nonstop action. Like I had to, I'm filming everything, so I had to like shut off my cameras because I had like 10 minutes of film left. I'm like, if I get this deer in here, I want to film it. So I had to shut it off, and I'm missing all of this running around back and forth. At one point, he ran her underneath my stand, and I come to full draw, and I'm, you know, yelling at him to stop, and he won't stop. And another 40 minutes goes by, and I watch him breed her like six or seven times, like at 50 yards in the thicket. And I'm like, oh my God, like this is incredible. Absolutely insane. And what finally happens is one of the three or four-year-olds gets a little too close, and he pushes him away. And when he goes to run the deer off, he circles in to about 28 yards. And I have an opening, and I stopped him and shoot him. And he goes tearing off. But within, while he's running away, the other bucks charge the doe. Because he's gone. The big boy is gone. He ran away. So yeah. They start running this doe ragged around my tree stand. I watched two other bucks breed her. And at one point, like I said, there was 10 plus bucks around this doe the whole time.
That is bananas.
It's the craziest sit I've ever had in my life. And, you know, I've seen, you know, big deer late season and seen all these deer and seen bucks fighting. I've seen breeding one other time, but that was the most insane morning, the most insane 2 hours I've ever had deer hunting.
What surprises me is that this buck fights off all these other bucks for however many hours. You don't know how many hours it was.
Yep.
Breeds her a ton of times. Then you shoot him and he goes, and this buck or this doe automatically allows two other bucks to breed her.
Yeah.
Without like, which is crazy. Like she would stand for these two other bucks without like pursuit. You know what I mean? So that must tell me like she wanted to breed right now. Like she didn't care who it was with. It was just like, I got the big dog, whatever, he's gone. I'm ready. Let's go. That blows my mind.
I think that's, it was crazy. Just one of those. It was that, you know, that 12, 8, 6 hour window where this is going to have to happen. And I mean, it's their choice. She's, like I said, there was not much pushing around for it.
Yeah, right. That's crazy. Well, that's a badass story. I have never seen that like breeding. I've only seen breeding a handful of times. Usually it's doesn't. By like,
a little buck on a doe fawn or something like that.
But yeah, this something was, like that.
Know, a huge doe, big matriarchal doe, you know, the 200 pounds, you know, huge doe, big buck. Like you don't see that very often, especially that close. No. I mean, it all happened inside like 70 yards the entire time.
Right. That's nuts.
Yeah.
Man, that would be a badass experience. Now, I haven't seen anything as from a breeding standpoint or a fighting standpoint. Well, I did watch two Boone and Crockett's fight one time, which was amazing. There was a hot doe that came, like she was bedded down in this little creek, and then she walks up, and then I saw this, like, it's almost like this buck knew where she was at, watched her bed down, then he bed down in this pine thicket, watched him stand up out of come out of this pine thicket. And then another one further down where her scent was blowing appeared as well. And then she ran up, or she crossed the creek to go up to a different property to where there's like this clover field. And they met. They came together and they met. And I was probably 40 yards away from it and watch it, dude. They just beat the shit out of each other for what felt like 30 minutes, right? They would tangle and then break up and then circle and then tangle again. It just sounded like someone was driving a truck through the woods, cracking branches, everything. So that's probably the most aggressive fight. But another cool quick story is, man, this would have been like 2007 or eight or something like that. I watched two bucks have a snort wheeze contest at each other. And they just went back and forth for like 15, 20 minutes where they saw each other, but they didn't move in on each other. And then one would snort wheeze, and then the other one would snort wheeze, and then one would snort wheeze, and then the other one. And they just stood there, and they didn't fight each other, but they just snort wheezed back and forth at each other for like 15 minutes. It was nuts. It was crazy.
And the thing that makes me think of is people get so worried about calling deer, about rattling, about grunting, about doing this. Same thing with turkeys. People are like, well, you know, if you do this or you do that, you know, you're going to freak them out. That just tells you right there, what are, you know, who's rattling on and off for 20 minutes, you know, 30 seconds at a time, 40 seconds at a time, or who's going to sit there and snort wheeze back and forth? Deer do it.
Yeah.
You know, deer do it all the time.
Yeah. Not like that. Yeah, I would say that what we experienced was very rare.
Right.
Right. But if I would say this, the podcast that you popped in on before we started recording this one today, our topic was like mistakes that we made. And I think I think I've called too much over the years. You know, I think I've blind called too much and got deer downwind of me that I didn't even see them. Right. Because they got downwind and busted me on some shit, you know?
Yeah, I can see that for sure. And, you know, I liken it to like with turkey hunting, like, well, you know, you're going to overcall. Have you ever sat in a field and just had a hen that won't shut up, like yelping nonstop for like 30 minutes? But everybody will tell you, well, you know, you just need to do a couple yelps. And if they respond, you need to stop. Really? Do you need to? Because I just watched, you know, a big hen nonstop yelping for 15 minutes straight.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So it's something to think about.
No, there's no such thing as a blanket statement, right? That's the takeaway on something like that. So, well, I tell you what, man, great conversation. We had a little hiccup there. We had a little emergency that I had to go take care of. But I do appreciate you taking time out of your day. And I want to have another conversation with you, more strategy focused, hopefully before the season starts. I'd love to pick your brain about a couple things, but I really do appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this. If you like the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, do me a favor, guys, and go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts, wherever you download the Nine Finger Chronicles, and give me a 5-star review. Give the podcast a nice review there. Let everybody else know. Share the social media content. That's how we spread the word. And I appreciate it. Have a good one, guys. Jesse, good luck this upcoming season, man.
Thanks. You too, Dan.